26. For the second day in a row, Britt the Younger traveled to the summit meetings on foot, accompanied only by Gwen. For the second day in a row, Philip and Martin were waiting at the door when they arrived. For the second day in a row, Britt pretended not to see Philip as she passed. For the second day in a row, Gwen made eye contact with Martin, who nodded a polite but curt greeting and went on his way. All four of them were particularly edgy this morning, because for the second day in a row, there had been no further attempt on Britt the Younger's life. There were a few theories as to why this might be, and none of them were particularly pleasant. It might be that the attempted murderer was taking his time, planning his next attempt, an attempt that might have some chance at success. Perhaps the perpetrator had given up and would make no further attempt, which would be a good thing, except that they might never find out who it was and would never be sure that they wouldn't strike again. It could be that whoever it was in fact planning another, possibly deadlier attack, and was waiting to make them think he or she had given up so that they dropped their guard. The sad fact was that no matter which of those possibilities was true, their course of action was the same. They had to go on about their business, remain ever vigilant, and slowly go insane from the suspense. What was worse was that the sharp decline in attempted Brit killings had started at almost the same moment as when Brit's electronic surveillance system had started. If and when another attempt was made, Brit would be able to look back through the database her new program was creating and find out who was using magic at that precise moment. All of the sorceresses in Atlantis and every delegate in town for the summit were registered and easily identifiable. The next time someone tried to kill Britt, they'd know who did it, which put them in the strange position of hoping for a violent attack that never seemed to come. Britt took her seat next to her fellow delegate Ida, the president of Atlantis. Once seated, Britt fell into her new routine of making a point to look everywhere. Anywhere but at Philip. She wasn't angry at Philip specifically. She was angry at the situation. Unfortunately for Philip, he was the only part of the situation that cared that she was angry. Therefore, when she chose to withdraw from the situation, it effectively meant that she was withdrawing from him. She missed him, but she knew that making up with Philip would just give Britt the Elder a happy memory of making up with Philip, and that felt like Philip was cheating on her. She knew that made no sense, and that just made her angrier, both at herself for acting crazy and at Britt the Elder for making her crazy. Most people can't have their cake and eat it too. Philip couldn't have his cake without eating it too, and as such, he would get no cake at all. Philip and Martin sat at their table and waited for the day's meetings to begin. Beside them, Gilbert and Sid, the tuxedo-clad dandies representing London in the late 1800s, sat down with broad smiles on their faces, placing their top hats on the table in front of them, their white gloves folded and tucked neatly inside.
"Well," Gilbert said, "I think that went well for our friends from Camelot today. Britt the Younger is clearly warming up to Philip."
"What do you mean?" Sid asked. "I thought she ignored him again."
"Oh yes, you're right, Sidney. She ignored him, quite so. A finer demonstration of the art of ignoration I've never seen. But did you not notice how she ignored him?"
"Sorry, Gil. It seems I'm ignorant of the art of ignorance. Please enlighten me that I may take note of her future ignorances."
See, that's your problem right there. You fell into the all-too-common trap of watching the ignorer. In this case, as in all cases, it is worthwhile to pay close attention to the ignored. Regard our friend Philip, the object of the lovely Brit's inattention."
Both magicians turned to study Philip in mock studiousness. Gilbert continued.
"Note the ostentatious sky-blue wizard robe. Observe the ridiculous matching pointy hat. Take a mental picture of his cliched wizard staff, festooned nonsensically with its bottle of what appears to be V8 juice. Would you not think any rational person would find it difficult to ignore a man with such a buffoonish appearance, even if he weren't accompanied everywhere by an assistant who dresses like a disco traffic cone?
I see your point, Sid said. It'd be easier to ignore a thumb in your eye.
Indeed. That, Sidney, my friend, is why the fact that the enchanting Miss Britt is going to the trouble to actively ignore Philip must be interpreted as an act of love.
Love? Sid asked.
Indeed, Gilbert said, rapping his cane on the table for emphasis. In fact, in Philip's case, I suspect it's the only act of love he ever receives.
Sid shook his head.
I think you're right that to ignore a buffoon like Philip would take so much effort that it could only be motivated by love. But I don't think it follows that Britt must logically love Philip. She might love ignoring him.
Gilbert considered this.
I will admit, it would be a pleasure to ignore Philip.
Gilbert and Sid looked at Philip and Martin, who did not look back or move in any way.
Oh dear, Gilbert said. Philip and Martin appear to be ignoring us.
Which, by your reasoning, means that they love us?
I fear so, Sidney.
What do we do?
We'll just have to signal our lack of interest in the only way they seem to understand, by continuing to watch every move they make.
Britt the Elder called the meeting to order. As she started her daily opening remarks, Martin leaned over to Philip and whispered,
"What could we have done to those guys to make them hate us this much?"
Philip muttered,
"I don't know, but we have a few hundred years to come up with something good."
The day's meetings included a debate on how to best prevent the abuse of power. A delegate from the United States in the 1890s, whose costume indicated some experience as a traveling patent medicine dealer, was arguing in favor of draconian punishments for any time traveler, sorcerer, or wizard who is found abusing their power, up to and including, in extreme cases, death. He argued that one could never stop all abuse, but that fear of punishment would keep the vast majority of people in line, and that those who did still abuse their powers would do so more quietly and to a lesser degree. He said,
"I know that most of you have no stomach for violence."
He paused to smooth his thinning hair. Martin was impressed at how comfortable he looked. This man was clearly used to speaking to large groups of people.
"The beauty of capital punishment," he continued, "is that you only have to do it once to make your point."
Toward the back of the hall, someone let out a quiet cough that echoed through the hall. The man speaking shrugged, as if the coffer had made a valid point.
"Okay, once in a while. Occasionally. We'll only have to kill people occasionally, but only people who deserve it. Evil people who really have it coming. People who we can all agree need to be put down like rabid dogs. And we will do it humanely and without taking any pleasure in it."
There was a long silence. Martin was still impressed with how relaxed the patent medicine salesman from the Old West seemed. Clearly, he was used to large groups of people not believing him. The silence was broken, not by crowd noise or Britt the Elder's gavel, but by a hollow popping noise followed by a groaning creak. All eyes turned to the source of the noise, one of the large statues, Hetty Lamarr in this case, that decorated the outer perimeter of the room. It had been damaged at its thinnest point near the base, and, to nobody's surprise, it was slowly toppling over, directly toward the table where Britt the Younger and President Ida sat. The delegates from the surrounding tables instinctively scattered, as did Ida. Britt had been through this before and did not look concerned. She just rolled her eyes and said,
"Really? We're back to this?"
The statue came down directly on top of her with a deafening crash, followed by the now familiar cloud of dust and flying debris. One could just make out the form of Brit sitting on the floor in the rubble. Her chair was destroyed, but she was unharmed, as expected. What nobody expected was the hail of arrows that zipped over their heads from the back of the room, plunged into the heart of the dust cloud, and struck Brit the Younger. Despite the familiarity of the attack, Martin was instantly in full panic mode. He knew the instant it started that this time was different somehow. In a frenzied half-second of observation, Martin saw that there were more arrows than ever before, easily 100 of them, if not more. The arrows didn't seem to have conventional, sharp arrowheads, which in the past had bounced off of Brit's skin harmlessly. Instead, these arrows were tipped with some formless black material. Martin suspected tar. Whatever it was, the arrows were clinging to Brit rather than bouncing off. The arrows each seemed to trail a thin cable, no bigger around than Martin's pinky finger. On their own, the ropes were most likely not very strong, but the 100 of them together were likely quite strong indeed, an idea that was reinforced when the cables pulled tight and dragged Brit across the floor with great speed. Brit tumbled sideways. Martin's eyes followed the ropes and saw them terminate at the far end of the hall, disappearing into a seemingly unbroken section of the wall. Martin glanced back to Brit and saw that Philip had already sprinted the distance between them and was lunging to grab her. He got a grip on Brit's outstretched hand and planted his feet on the floor. Philip's staff tumbled to the ground. He discarded it to grip Brit's free hand with both of his own. The ropes pulled tight, lifting Brit off of the ground. She tried to extend her other arm, but couldn't. Her entire left side was covered with the tar arrows, and she wasn't strong enough to fight the pull from the ropes. Philip slid across the floor like a water skier, barely slowing Brit's progress toward the wall. Without thinking, Martin reached into his pocket, and in one deft motion withdrew and threw his beanbag with all of his might. It shot forward like a line drive and hit Philip square in the back. As the beanbag made contact, Martin said, "Bamf!" and was instantly standing behind Philip. Philip was still moving forward quite quickly, so Martin dove and seized Philip by the ankles with his free arm, which caused Philip to fall forward and, without being able to catch himself with his hands, land directly on his face. Brit also fell fast and landed hard. Then the three of them slid across the floor with no discernible change in their speed. Martin didn't have time to think. He just knew on an instinctive level that he needed to do anything he could to slow them down. His brain ran through everything it knew, looking for an idea, and when it got one, he acted on it without hesitation. Martin kept his left arm hooked around Philip's ankles, and with his right, he pointed his staff in Philip and Brit's general direction and said, "Excusi Vin!" A foul-smelling jet of purple smoke erupted from Brit's ribcage. In the cavernous hall, the sound was more like a pulse jet than a whoopee cushion. The spell had landed, as Martin had hoped, in a place on Brit's body that aimed at least a bit toward the wall, so their progress did slow. Unfortunately, the jet also vectored toward the side, so most of its thrust sent Brit sliding across the hall. Brit slid in an arc, pushing through a tangled mass of tables, chairs, and slow-moving delegates. Most of the objects Brit went through fell directly on Philip and Martin as they were carried along helplessly behind her. Philip coughed in the thick, malodorous vapor trail and shouted,
"What is that?"
"Something Gary invented," Martin replied.
"Should have guessed."
The three of them came to a crashing, clattering halt in a massive heap of jumbled furniture against the wall. But while their sideways motion had stopped, they were still being pulled relentlessly toward the portal in the wall. They were dragged painfully through the thicket of table and chair legs. Martin tried to hook his legs into the furniture, but that just resulted in a portion of the pile being dragged along with them and did nothing to slow them down. He kicked his legs free and attempted to get traction against the wall and the floor, trying to wedge himself between them somehow, but it was no good. He became aware that someone had grasped his left leg. He peeked down and saw Gwen hugging his leg to her torso with both arms, but she could get no more traction than he could, and they were all sliding toward the portal. The purple jet sputtered out and their speed increased. Martin caught a quick glimpse of the path ahead and saw that the ropes, rather than extending straight out of the wall, now bent at the edge of the otherwise invisible portal and stretched along the wall until they attached to Brit. Martin felt the stretching force on his spine increase, and their progress slowed again. He glanced toward his feet, and to his surprise, saw that Gilbert had taken hold of Gwen's waist, and Sid had hold of his. Sadly, their shiny black dress shoes provided almost no traction at all. Sid extended his white-tipped ebony cane and shouted,
"Abracadabra! A la trahiri!"
An undulating blue energy field extended from Sid's cane to the nearest firmly anchored object, another of the massive goddess statues. Their motion stopped again. Sid's spell momentarily counterbalanced the pull from the ropes. They all were lifted off of the ground as the rope stretched tight. It was a tug of war between the irresistible force and the immovable object, and they were the rope. Straining from the exertion of keeping his grip and the pain of Gwen keeping hers, Martin found the strength to say,
"Really? Abracadabra?"
From the back of the group, Sid shouted,
"Shut up!"
Brit was unable to move her head due to the several tar-tipped arrows that were stuck to it, but she could swivel her eyes just enough to look at Philip. He had a two-handed death grip on her free wrist and a look of desperate determination on his face.
"Just let go, Philip," Brit said. "Thanks, but just let go."
"No!"
Philip barked.
"I won't die, Philip."
"We don't know that."
"We do. She's here. I can't die."
Gwen and Gilbert were both shouting about something, but neither Philip nor Brit took any notice. Whatever it was couldn't be as important as this. Philip said,
"We don't know that. We can't know that. You might be killed, and I'm not going to let it happen."
"Philip, I'm not going to die."
"I'm not willing to take that chance."
"If you get dragged in with me, maybe we both die,"
Philip said.
"I am willing to take that chance."
Brit said something else, but her words were drowned out by the horrendous sound of the destruction of the statue that was anchoring them. Like her sisters before her, the statue of Mary Dyer gave way at its thinnest, weakest point. Unlike her sisters, she broke with a terrible cracking noise, not a pop, and she did not fall gracefully to the floor, but instead was slammed down by the force of Sid's spell directly onto Sid, Gilbert, Gwen, and the lower half of Martin. They all would have been hit if they hadn't shot forward the instant the statue gave way. The shock from the impact caused Gwen to lose her grip, and Martin, Philip, and Brit slid along the floor at breakneck speed. Brit finally reached the portal and disappeared into the wall. Philip went into the portal up to his shoulders, then pulled his head and one arm back out. He held his grip on Brit with one hand, flailing desperately for something to hold onto with the other, but there was nothing. Philip's arms, head, and torso were consumed. Only his legs remained visible. Martin held his grip, but his motion stopped. He was aware that something was keeping him from moving forward, but Philip's legs were still being drawn in. Martin strained for a moment, but then Philip was gone, and Martin was holding a pair of empty boots. Martin was pulled away from the portal. It was instantly clear that he'd been kept from going in himself by spells cast by one of the fakirs, two Atlantean sorceresses, and a gypsy. They all had finally realized what was happening and how they could stop it. He didn't blame them for the lateness of their actions. Though it had felt like an eternity to him, the whole ordeal may have only taken less than 30 seconds. Martin gazed miserably at the blank patch of wall that had just swallowed his friends. He saw Gilbert approach the wall and knock on it with his cane. It was solid. Wherever the portal went, it was closed now. The meeting hall was a scene of utter devastation. The furniture was all wrecked and thrown about willy-nilly. Two of the statues were destroyed, and a malodorous purple haze still tainted the air and hung in a sinister cloud around the ceiling. Martin felt a gentle kick at his ribs. He looked up and saw that Sid was offering him a hand up, which he accepted. As he got to his feet, Martin said,
"Thanks for pitching in. I know you don't much like Philip and me. Why is that?"
Sid ignored the question, instead saying,
Doesn't matter. We have nothing against Brit. Any idea where they went?
Martin shook his head.
Well, then, do you have any idea who's behind all this?
Until recently, my chief suspect was you two.
Sid let out a resigned sigh and said,
And you wonder why we don't like you.
Gwen ran up and hugged Martin. Martin smiled. Sid grimaced. Then she hugged Sid, which made Martin grimace and Sid smile. Gwen said,
Thank you for your help.
Sid said,
We'd have jumped in sooner, but we didn't think there was any real danger until Brit disappeared.
Martin said,
But you both jumped in before Brit went into the wall.
Sid shook his head.
No, not that Brit, the other one.
Gwen said,
We tried to tell Brit the Younger that, but clearly none of you were listening. While you were sliding across the floor, Brit the Elder vanished.
Martin was aghast.
You mean she left?
No,
Gwen said.
She looked surprised, then she disappeared.
Martin's blood ran cold. It would take some time to make sense of this, if it was even possible, which was never a sure thing when time travel was involved. Brit the Elder disappearing was bad news. Heck, Brit the Elder looking surprised was bad news. Martin had the sudden, sinking feeling that maybe Philip had been right all along, which, for several reasons, was the worst news of all. A single voice rang out strong and clear above the confused chatter in the room. All eyes turned to the podium, Brit the Elder's podium, and saw Ida, the duly elected president of Atlantis.
I think,
she said,
given what just happened, that we should adjourn for the day.